Well, amen. Thanks for worshiping with you today. It's awesome to have you with us, whether you're watching out in the atrium or our tent is closed, a little too cold for the tent now, but we are one community gathered together celebrating what we sang about, that there is a God who took our place, and because of that, we can be forgiven. And I tell you, as we continue in our series, The Brightest Worship in the Darkest Hour, how we see worship in the darkest week of Jesus' life, we're going to see exactly what we just sang about in today's passage. Pilate is going to be seated in the judgment seat when Jesus is brought before him. And maybe I'll read the whole passage first to get a feel for the moment, and then we'll unpack it together, because it is a dramatic moment in time. It begins by saying, "Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Jesus says, 'It is as you say.' While he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, 'Do you not hear the things they testify against you?' And he answered him not one word." Now Pilate has seen people beg for their life, plead, cry, blubber. He's never seen someone with such confidence they just stand there quietly. So the governor marveled greatly at this. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing the multitude, one prisoner whom they wished to be released. That was for Passover. Now at that time, there was a notorious prisoner. His name was Barabbas. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ?" And Pilate knew that they had handed him over to them because of envy. But he was sitting in the judgment seat. While he was there, his wife sent him a little note that said, "Have nothing to do with this man. It's a just man, for I had a dream about him last night." Basically, let him go. "I suffered many things today in a dream because of him," Jesus said. But the chief priests and the elders had persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barnabas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said to him, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called the Christ?" They said to him, "Let him be crucified." The governor said, "What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." Now when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather a tumult was rising, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." Then all the people cried out, "His blood be on us and our children!" Then he released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus scourged and then delivered him to be crucified. So here in this passage, as Jesus stands before the crowd, we see that he's going to take our place. We see that he took Barabbas' place. And we're going to contrast the difference between worship and what I'm going to call why-ship. Worship is recognizing that what we're seeing here is the King of the universe. And worship says, "I worship the King who right there in that moment and on the cross, he took my place. So I'm going to place that King on the throne of my life. Wow, the King who would die for me, you're on the throne." Why-ship is a little different. What's why-ship? Well, it's a word I made up, but you can hear it in your heart. You can always hear it in the back seat of the car with your kids and grandkids. You can also hear it when management's out of the room, when the boss is out of the room. It sounds like this. Why are we doing it that way? Why is it taking so long? Why did you go left? You should have gone right. Why did you decide to go that way? Why am I putting up with this? Why do I have to put up with this? Why me? Why, if I was in charge, things would be going perfectly. Why, if I was in charge, we'd do it a different way. Why I make myself the king and I take his place on the throne of my life? Yeah, God, I'll take it from here. I think I can run my life a little bit better than you. Why-ship. I have a friend of mine named Scott. He called me a few weeks ago. He said he and his wife are just kind of in that great season of life, empty nest, got great things planned, things are just going incredibly well, celebrating their anniversary. His wife had a medical thing that happened. They went to the doctor, who sent him to another doctor, who sent him to a specialist. The specialist came in and said, there's no easy way to say this, but you have stage 4 ovarian cancer, and it's metastasized to your lungs. And you can make some decisions about chemotherapy, but honestly, we need to call in hospice. You might only have a few weeks to live. And they were devastated. And yet I watched him say, we chose, and we're choosing, to worship God as king, even in this moment. He actually used the idea of Jesus being his king. I didn't hear a lot of why me, though I was feeling like why him. He says, God is still sovereign even in the midst of this. So they go to another specialist. His wife gets on WebMD. They got literally 1,000 people praying for him. She's on WebMD, you know, always a recipe for anxiety, typically, when you're on WebMD. And she says, there's this condition very similar to what they say I have that mimics these conditions. It's like 1 in every 10 million people have it, extremely rare, maybe even more rare than that. So though they tell the doctor, he's like, yeah, I'm sure it's that, but we'll check. And to their absolute delight, she had that condition, which is benign, not cancerous. And though it needs to be removed, they said, this is amazing, but you're going to live a full life. And a week apart, I saw he and his wife celebrate that God is king at the worst day of their life and now at the best day in their life in a long time. How do we worship him as king even when we don't understand what's going on? So three things we're going to look at today. Do we question the king? Do we replace the king? And do we wash our hands of the king rather than putting him on the throne room of our life? Let's start with the first one. The first aspect is questioning the king. I think in a lot of ways this is what we do, exactly what Pilate did, exactly what the chief priest did. We question God, we question the king, we engage in why-ship. Look how it begins, and you see two words here in Greek. They're going to show what they did. Here's a passage in Matthew chapter 27. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked. And the word here in Greek means to accost someone with inquiry. Why? Explain yourself. Prove yourself. And boy, isn't that what's in my heart toward God often. Now, in this case, it's a specific question. Are you king of the Jews? And Jesus, whose whole life is on the line, you're talking about the most important speech of your life, you want to be free, he just says, yeah, it is as you say. The absolute confidence he has, the absolute security he has in the midst of the most horrific of circumstances. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, and the word accused there is the word in Greek to interrogate someone, to charge with offense. They're charging him with offense. That's the time I get defensive. That's the time I start fighting back. Not Jesus. When people are questioning him and accusing him and accosting him and charging him, he entrusts himself to the king of the universe. Tozer is kind of a famous Christian writer, and I think he talks about this tendency we all have to put God in the witness chair and we become the prosecutor. He says it this way. He says, man in his arrogance places God on trial, demanding divine justification for what he's done, while forgetting his own place as the created. Francis Schaeffer says something similar. In our time, we do not tremble before God as sinners. Instead, we sit in judgment, demanding he explain himself to our satisfaction. Boy, isn't there a sense in us, look how good I've been, look what a good life I've lived. God, you owe me. Why would you let this happen to me? we often are the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Have you ever heard the story of the Mutiny on the Bounty? It's a story, it's a true story, but a captain, Captain Bly, who had a ship in England, he was going to go around South America and end up in Tahiti, where he'd been before. He's a master navigator. Because of bureaucracy and a few things, a ship got smaller than it needed to be, and they left a few weeks later, which was very problematic going around the tip of South America. But he had a crew, and one of his crew members' name was Christian Fletcher. Or Fletcher Christian, rather. And this is a kid he invested in, was going to teach him navigation, somebody he'd had at his home. And he said, listen, if you come with me, I'm going to teach you navigation. And also, in Tahiti is this incredible untapped market that you could spend your whole life getting very, very wealthy in this plan I have for you and for us. So sure enough, they get on the boat, they make their way over. Sure enough, they had left several weeks early because of bureaucracy. It was a tough voyage. Things were difficult. They get to the island. Things are going pretty well. But Christian's kind of being a little lazy, and the captain calls him out on it. Well, just a few days later, Captain Bly awakens to a gun to his cheek and a knife to his neck, and Christian leads a mutiny on the ship called the Bounty. And they take Captain Bly, they stick him into a longboat, and they push him out and say, your time as captain is over. We'll take it from here. And you're like, the guy invested in you. He taught you how to navigate. He got you this opportunity. He had a plan for your life, and now you're going to push him out as if you know how to run your life better than him? And Christian is never heard from again, and Captain Bly actually makes his way back to England from Tahiti, having only a longboat to where he started. Man, haven't I been Christian? Not indebted to everything God's done for me and his wisdom and his trust. One time he rebukes me or challenges me, suddenly I push him away and think I can run my life better. We question God. We also replace God. That's kind of what you see here at Pilate. He's got a chance to replace the king. Who are we going to get? Who are you going to release? The king or this other guy we'll replace him with. Now, at the feast of Passover, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner, not just a prisoner, a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Now, look at his name there. If you see the first part, Bar. So if you, in the Bible, often it will say, Jesus Bar Joseph. You might even hear that today if you're talking Jewish circles. So Jesus bar Joseph means Jesus bar the son of Joseph. So the word bar means son of. Second part, Abbas. In Romans 8 it says, the Holy Spirit testifies within us, Abba, Father. So Abba means father. So Barabbas' name literally means son of the father. There's a couple texts, Synodic texts and manuscripts, not as reliable, they give us his first name as Jesus. Jesus Barabbas, the son of the father. Therefore, when they'd gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas, the son of the father, or Jesus, whose name means Yahweh, or Jehovah is my salvation, who is called the Christ, the anointed one, the one sent by God? Here's your choice. Do you want the king that God sent or this other son of the father that we know is notorious? And they're going to replace the good king with the bad king. The good king with the prisoner. And in here we get a beautiful picture of the main message of the Bible. The bad son goes free because the good son took his place and dies for him. And that is exactly what the main message of the Bible is. The God of the universe dies the death we should have lived because he lived the life we should have lived. He lived the life we should have lived that we couldn't. We're incapable of living that way. Then he died the death we deserved because we couldn't live that way. And because he took our place, the bad son is released and the good son dies for his release. And when you realize that's what the God of the universe did for me, he took my place so I could be free, so I could be forgiven, you're now indebted to the good son, even if you know you're the bad son. And yet, why is it that you and I, as we talked a few weeks ago about the wabbit behind your habit, why do we replace the God of the universe with some replacement God, some other thing that we think could run our life better than he could, like ourselves, despite our track record? And this isn't just a fanciful story. It's not a mythical story. It's a historic story. The real God came in the real universe to do this for us, to be our Christ, to be our King, the Anointed One. Now, we know that for years people made fun of the Bible, specifically about Pilate. They said Pilate wasn't a real person. There certainly was not a prefect of Judea. But recent scholarship has shown that not to be true. Pilate is, of course, historical, and the Bible's been true all along. They were digging down this location at Caesarea Maritime, and they found, sure enough, a giant plaque that has Pontius Pilate's name on it. He had dedicated a little temple on behalf of the emperor, a place you could worship, and it says on there, Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, just like the Bible said for hundreds and thousands of years, that he made and dedicated the Tiberium to divine Augustus. A real person put Jesus on trial. A real person released a bad son and killed the good son. We found coins. The talk about from that time period that person he dedicated to, Tiberius Caesar, was a real person. We found other coins that mentioned Pontius Pilate. These were minted under Pontius Pilate, 29 to 30 AD. A real person in real history had a real moment to decide, is he going to replace the king with a prisoner? And he did, despite all evidence to the contrary. What evidence? Well, look at it all. Matthew gives it to us. He knew. He knew the reason the crowds brought and the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the elders. He knew why they really brought Jesus. It was clear. He knows envy when he can see it. It's because of envy. That's why he's here. It's not justice. And while he's sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sends him a note saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I suffered many things today in a dream because of him." She gets a divine dream. She knows he's just. She sends a note. "Hey, honey, I know you don't want me involved in your affairs, but you got to know something about this one." Which, by the way, wives, if you ever want to memorize a verse about maybe why husbands should listen to you, here's one just to think about. Matthew 27, verse 19. You know, Pilate, if he listened to his wife, we wouldn't be in all this mess, honey. "Well, come on, you had a dream. Maybe something you ate last night. Maybe you should take my intuition, let alone the divine dream, and my instinct as a just man. Take it a little bit more seriously." But he doesn't. His own intuition, his own facts, his own assessment of the circumstances. But here's why. Jesus referenced several years ago in the accounts that Pilate had really let this revolt occur, where he'd mixed some blood with the Galileans in this thing that happened. And so the Romans really had Pilate on a short leash. If he let another revolt happen in Jerusalem, he was going to get yanked. So his replacement is power. He can't lose his power. He can't lose his position. He's trying to weigh the evidence here, but the main thing that's driving all his decisions is he can't have a revolt because he can't lose his power. I think that's why all of us have a tendency to make the wrong decision or compromise because some other thing, replacement God, in this case his power and his position, was more important than doing the right thing. Why would anyone replace this just king with a replacement king? Well, I just mentioned, he knew it was because of envy. He knew he's a just man. His wife had told him because of a dream. We see it. He washes his hands because he knows that what's happening here is not right. I'm washing my hands of this. And yet he's been entrusted by Rome and entrusted by the God of the universe who puts political positions in place to execute justice. He's sitting on the judgment seat where he's supposed to administer justice. But instead he replaces the king because he doesn't want to lose power. He doesn't want to lose position. You ever mistaken the good king for the wrong king to run your life? thinking that money or position or reputation would be a better driver than the God of the universe. When I was at Moody Bible Institute, where I got my undergrad, I remember this actor came up one time and was playing out that story that we just read today. And he got up in real dramatic fashion around Easter time, and he says, "And Pilate came before the crowd and said, 'Which do you have today? Shall I give you Jesus, who is called the Christ, or Barnabas?' 'Who wants Barnabas?' And the crowd cried out, 'Barnabas, Barnabas, we want Barnabas.'" And we're all going, "I don't think it's Barnabas. I think it's Brad." And he went on for about 5 minutes. It was powerful, it was beautiful, but he had mistaken the name, which I do all the time. So there's no judgment here. Barnabas is a guy in the New Testament known as the son of encouragement who helped mentor the Apostle Paul. I'm like, man, I had no idea he was up there with Jesus. He mistook the king. He mistook the story, the good guy and the bad guy. In 2007, there was a story, true story of a film student who's walking along the subway, and he tripped and fell in, and there's a train coming at him. There was a construction worker who'd worked in those tunnel systems who saw him fall down. There was no time to pull him out, no time to stop the train. This construction worker jumps in with him, wraps his arm around him. Because he worked in those tunnel systems, he knew there was a little crack they could hide in. Shoves him in there in a second, wraps his body around him and says, "Don't move." Sure enough, the train comes by. Everybody to their horse. He sees the train go past them. And as the train leaves, Wesley, the construction worker, pulls out this film student. A few bruises on his hat and his outfit, but both of them survived. This construction worker jumped into the trenches with the film student, put his life on the line, and showed him how he could be rescued from death. Is that film student ever going to forget Wesley's life or Wesley's name? No. This is the guy who put himself on the line for me, who showed me how to escape death. That's what this king is doing in this passage. God is jumping into the trenches and showing us the way in which we can defeat death based on what he knows and what he's doing for us. Don't replace that king with anything else. No matter what kind of sales and marketing that other king might give you. Which brings us to the third thing we do. We move from questioning to replacing to washing. Do you wash your hands of the king? I know I do. I rationalize what I do. I don't take responsibility for what I do. Like Pilate, I know I did the wrong thing, but it's like, well, I had a good reason for doing it. You need to understand. It's not my fault. That's what happens here in the passage. The chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barnabas. I did this at the last service too. See? Ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What shall then I do with Jesus, who's called Christ?" And they said, "Let him be crucified." If you ever heard the word excruciating, it's a word that was invented by the Romans. Crucifixion was designed to be the most torturous, slow-motion death where you would die by suffocation. The sounds that came out of a human body during crucifixion were not like sounds came out any other time. So they invented a word called ex out of excruciating the cross. Because when you had excruciating pain, it's because you were being tortured in the worst possible way ever invented by human beings, which was the cross. And they're demanding that he be crucified. The governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all against them, but rather a tumult was rising, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, and said, "I'm innocent of the blood of this just person." Remember, he's washing his hands. There's only one other time I found in the Bible that you wash your hands over something. We're going to come back to that. He says, "This is a just person." And all the people answered saying, "Yeah, his blood be on us and our children." And here again is the irony. They're saying his blood be on us. We know we're doing the right thing. His blood be on us because we'll take full responsibility. But the irony is, The way you find forgiveness is the same way. You recognize, I'm to blame for putting him to death, and his blood be on me and my children so we can find forgiveness and freedom. The irony and twist here is genius. Then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. There's a couple different accounts historically about what scourging's like, but in general, it was a whipping. 40 times you'd be whipped, and most men could not survive the scourging. You'd often tie the hands of the prisoner together, often hoist them up on a rope that went through a pillar that had a metal circle at the top, so you could hoist it up and you could yank them all the way up on their tiptoes so their skin wasn't completely tight. Then they would take a whip, and often the strands on the whip had pieces of bone or glass or metal in it, so when you were struck, it would grab hold of the flesh and yank out pieces of it. By the time you were done with 40 lashings, many historians say that the veins and the arteries were fully shown. The brutality of the bleeding, the brutality that many people, when they got done with the scourging, were barely recognized as human beings because every square inch of the body had been brutalized. And I say that with such graphicness so you would know what Jesus did to take your place, what he was willing to endure for you and I just in the scourging. And yet many of us will say, I know God forgives me, but I just cannot forgive myself. Or we say, I'm going to beat myself up a little bit longer for this because I can't believe I did it. It was so stupid. I broke my promises, right? Understandable. But see Jesus' brutal scourging, his brutal crucifixion, and ask yourself this. Is your beating yourself up for one more month or one more year going to somehow add to something that was missing in the beating of Jesus? Or is what he endured enough that you can say, I don't deserve to be forgiven, but me beating myself up, me punishing myself, is not going to add. His death was sufficient. I am just so thankful he took my place. Here's one artist's rendering of Pilate bring Jesus before the crowd. If this is even partially historically accurate, which it's not, of course, he's not Middle Eastern, he's Norwegian, looks like. Jesus the Norwegian here. Maybe he's got a couple cuts on his back, but if this was the real presentation after the scourging, he would just be almost unrecognizable as a human being after those 40 lashes. And now he's going to the crucifixion. I mentioned there's one time in the Bible where there's another washing of the hands, and this might begin God in his divine plan showing us a few more pictures of what's happening here. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, God says that if anyone is slain and you don't know who killed him, someone with innocent blood is killed but you don't know who the killer is, the elders nearest to the slain man are to take a heifer. They're to take it down to the valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and right there in that spot where the blood is calling out for justice, for we don't know who did it or how they did it, but it's calling out. Somebody's got to pay for this. The elders are to take a heifer and break his neck right at that spot. And the priests, the sons of Levi, who come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister, to be like mediators between the two, to minister between the problem and God and justice coming together. So a poor cow, a heifer, has its neck broken, innocent blood shed to cover the innocence of blood. A mediator, a priest, had to come and mediate on behalf of this. And all the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will what? Wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken. Now, there's no way Pilate had any of this in mind, or probably rarely even probability. But here is God showing how in this moment one is washing his hands over the innocent one who's dying to pay for those who have shed blood and the calling out for justice. And it only gets better as you keep reading. And then they will answer and say, our hands have shed this blood. Our hands have not shed this blood. We don't know who did this, nor have our eyes seen it. But God, we need you to provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed. Do not lay the innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. Doesn't that sound like the absolute flip side of what the crowd is saying? You let your blood be upon us. They're saying, don't let the blood be upon us. What happened here? We need you to atone for that blood. And atonement will be provided on their behalf for the blood by God. So you shall put away the guilt of the innocent blood from among you when you did what was right in the sight of the Lord. So what does it mean to do what's right in the sight of the Lord? You trust God to atone for the justice being called out for you by doing it his way and let something else innocent die in your behalf, and you wash your hands saying, God, you're providing the sacrifice. As you heard Neil earlier talking about, one of the things we do as a church is we encourage people to come and understand this message. And in doing so, they end up being baptized to say, this baptism is a picture of what God's been doing in me. I get it. It's not my works. It's not my justification. It's about the gift of what he did for me. So a couple months ago in our exploring service, I was interviewing my friend Dave Newman. And Dave shared how he, coming to our exploring service, was able to finally understand this message that Jesus died for him. Let's watch this story together.
So then a few years back, my wife started going to Horizon back when I was at the high school. And every week she'd come in and she'd say, Dave, you aren't going to believe what they played. They played the Allman Brothers today. Dave, they played The Who. Dave, they played your favorite, the Doobie Brothers. Uh-huh. You got to come and check them out. So I came and checked them out, and I like to tell people that Kenny got me in the door and Chad kept me there. Okay? It's not just Chad, it's the exploring service, uh-huh. Okay? And that's a much better fit for me than any other churches I've ever been to. I've learned a bunch of things. I want to point out that I did get baptized at age 60, so my parents baptized me when I was young, as an mm-hmm. infant. I chose to make that choice myself mm-hmm. so that I could kind of tell my kids and the world, my friends, that I do believe in Jesus, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's important to stand up and say that. I also learned from coming here that I was raised on good works. You have to earn your way into heaven, and I truly believe that. And as a good German Catholic growing up, self-reliance and all about doing good things mm-hmm. and being good to other people, even the golden rule say, you know, do the right mm-hmm. thing, right?
Yeah.
Be moral enough, but you've told me over and over again, as other people have, that that's not what it's all about. It's mm-hmm. about accepting Jesus for mm-hmm. who he is. So that's my number one thing. I still struggle with that, okay? Mm-hmm. I just brought up on that good works thing, but that's the big learning for me.
Yeah, I always say that the idea feels like, well, if I know for sure I'm getting in heaven, I'm not going to do anything good, but it's a lot like the difference between a paycheck and a gift. Paycheck is, I'm paying you for what you've done. That'd be good and bad.
Yep.
A gift is, despite what you've done, I'm giving you a gift. And now you're so overwhelmed, like, I don't deserve this. I can't believe you got this for me. Man, how can I please you? What can I do? How can I be as loving to others as you've been to me? So it can actually be, instead of I have to do it, I now want to do it. And that's really what Christianity does.
Dave goes on to talk about the fact that he's found himself going to church when he wasn't with his wife. And this desire for the scripture and desire to know God that came out of understanding that gift. What do you do when you're in the presence of the King of the universe? Do you question him with wyship? Or do you allow him to question you? I'm being questioned by the King of the universe. I'm the one in the defense chair. Do I replace the King of the universe with some other god, some other king? Or do I jaw-droppingly stand in worship that the King took my place and I went free? Do I wash my hands? Well, I don't need forgiveness. I just need another chance to do good works. Or do you let him wash you clean? I'll tell you this, I'll take Jesus' washing over my washing any day. Worship is understanding that the King of the universe took my place, and because of that, I'm placing him on the throne of my heart. I want to give you a chance to do that today. Maybe it's for the first time you're getting, oh, I finally get what this Jesus thing is about. For many of us, we've been Christians for many years. I've been Christian for about 40-something years now. And I still put myself on the throne almost weekly, if not daily. Today will be a chance to dethrone yourself and put the real king on the real throne. Let's pray. Say, Father, wash me. Forgive me for my why-ship attitude towards you. I worship you for taking my place, for dying for me. And I choose to see your beating as sufficient for my forgiveness. And I thank you for it. In Jesus' name, amen.